time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, pieces of paper in the way. Welcome to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine program on the third Thursday of every month between 2 and 3 p.m. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper.
Can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall, loving you later as if at all. No right minds could wrong be this many times.
I'm delighted to welcome Steve Orr, the new owner of Black Dome Press, formerly in Hensonville, now in Delmar. Steve took over earlier this year when longtime owner Debbie Allen suddenly decided to retire. Black Dome, of course, is renowned for its catalogue of books about the local region, including Historic Hudson, An Architectural Portrait, Rip Van Winkle Railroads, and the Catskill Mountain House. It was also recently recognised for an IPPI, an Independent Publishers Book Award. So welcome to Between the Lines and congratulations on both assuming the helm of Black Dome and also of the IPPI.
Thank you very much, Anne.
First of all, just let me say that this, of course, was hardly a new venture for you. You had worked there as the editor for 18 years.
Yes, I've been with the company since 1993, worked on their eighth book that they published, and we're now on about 75 books, so it's been a long road so far, and I hope a longer road ahead.
Yes, indeed. And well, you clearly enjoyed the job to stay there so long. Did you know that Debbie was going to retire? Was this sort of the game plan?
No, I really had no clue. I knew that retirement was something that she was thinking of. I thought it was still a few years down the road, and but apparently she made the decision back in the spring and took a little time to notify me because she wanted to try to make an arrangement, work it out so that I could purchase the company and keep Black Dome alive.
So there was never a question in your mind about taking it over. This was definitely something you wanted to do.
I thought about it overnight, basically. Okay. I bought my job, which I do love, and I'm glad to that Black Dome has survived and will continue to survive. It's a great little company.
It is, and it's really unique in Greene County. There's nothing else. There are no other publishing houses in Greene County.
Not in Greene County, no. There is one in Delaware County called Purple Mountain Press, a fine little press. Again, family-owned. They've been around for many more years than Black Dome. Black Dome's been around now for 21 years. Purple Mountain has probably been 30, 35, 40 years.
What did you think initially when you decided to take it over? Did you think, oh, we'll just continue? Did you have any thoughts of changing things up, or what's the kind of goal here? What are your long-term and short-term plans?
Well, the short-term plan has been just to kind of frantically get everything set up in Delmar so that I would have an office to work from. It happened in the peak of our summer season, which is our busiest time of the year. So I was really scrambling there for a couple of months just to keep all the balls in the air and keep everything going. Long-term plans, I think the previous publisher, Deborah Allen, did a wonderful job. I think she raised the bar for regional presses in New York State. The design of her books, the polish, the professionalism that she brought to the local book market, I think is something to be emulated. I really don't have any plans to do anything drastically differently than she did. I think she did it well, and if I can do it at least as well, then I think I'll have accomplished a lot.
How has publishing changed in the 18 years that you have been there?
Well, right now it's probably going through its fastest pace of change with e-books, with unfortunately the closing of bookstores at a pretty remarkable and record rate. The independent bookstores are having a tough time of it. There are some very viable and energetic independent bookstores in the region, but unfortunately they're becoming few and far between. We're losing more every year. And we've also lost one of the colossal bookstores this year, Borders.
Borders, yes.
Which is a very bad thing. Barnes & Noble seems to be thriving. Of course, the internet is thriving, particularly Amazon. So those are all changing the publishing scene. As far as Black Dome Press, with our kind of specialized niche market, I'm not particularly worried about any of those changes. I hate to see the independent stores having a hard time, and certainly miss the ones that are no longer with us. But I think the market for our books will remain strong.
Well, that's great to hear. So how much of your books do you sell online?
We have our own website, which is right now under construction, partly because of the changeover, partly because of changing security measures on the internet. We have to rework our order form to make it more secure, so we're working on that right now. Amazon is a big customer of Black Dome Press. The online presence is becoming greater and greater. E-books probably will be the wave of the future, if the future isn't here already in that regard. Again, with Black Dome Press and the kind of books we publish, I don't see transitioning to e-books in the near future. Illustrations do not carry over well in the present e-book technology. I'm sure that will change. The technology improves and changes daily. So that in the future, right now, I don't have any plans to do e-books. And I also think the only people really making money on e-books are sites like Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and they're probably making most of their money from selling the gadgets, not the books.
Really? And so would you say that most of your books then are still sold through independent booksellers and Barnes & Nobles?
Yes, most of them. And we also, because our books are of interest to visitors to the region and the local population, our books also sell very well in stores that are not bookstores.
So that's another outlet.
They sell in pharmacies. They sell in outdoors stores. We have basically two lines of books. We publish history books on the region. We also have a nice trail guide and kayaking guide line of books as well. So those do very well in the outdoor stores.
And also outlets like historical sites like the Thomas Cole site in Olana.
Oh, yeah, they're very important as well. I didn't mean to leave you guys out, sorry. Olana and Thomas Cole site, you mentioned two of our best customers there. They've been very supportive, and we've tried in our own way to be supportive of them over the years. And up and down the Hudson Valley, there are so many terrific historic sites, everything from Lyndhurst down in Westchester County, up through our books do well in places like Fort Ticonderoga, mm-hmm. Fort Niagara, anywhere that people tend to congregate that are interested in Hudson Valley culture and history.
And that would seem to be a growing number of people, just based on the growing fame of Thomas Cole and this whole area and everything that, you know, the Hudson River School of Painting.
Absolutely. Thomas Cole's renown over the last 20 years has dramatically increased. There's a much greater appreciation of his work, as well as the work of the other Hudson River School artists. There's also a growing appreciation for the other historic heritage of the region, including the architectural heritage. 25, 30 years ago, there was very little mention of preserving historic architecture in places such as Hudson, mm-hmm. Or any of the other river towns in the Hudson Valley. Now it is a pretty strong movement, and there's a growing appreciation.
Right, hence your book, Historic Hudson.
Exactly. Exactly.
An architectural portrait.
And I'd like to think, in addition to that book and others being very successful for Black Dome Press, I'd also like to think that by our publishing those books, it increases in its own small way preservation of some of these wonderful structures that we have all around us.
Now, I know that we briefly discussed e-books earlier, but what about things like apps? And would you think about creating projects for cell phones or for all of the variety of screens that there are out there in media?
I would be interested in looking at all of those options. I'm getting a little bit older myself, and hopefully won't be too many decades before I retire as well. So I'm not quite as gadget friendly as some of the younger generation that will be listening, I hope, to this interview. So right now I don't have any plans in that regard, but I'm looking at all options.
So let's just talk about some of the books. Now, I know that you have a big book coming out on Saturday, November the
19th.
Why don't you tell us about that?
I'm very excited about it. Speaking of architectural preservation, this book certainly fits right into that line of our titles. The title is Ulster County, New York, The Architectural History and Guide. It's written by retired SUNY New Paltz art history professor William B. Rhodes, who is probably without a doubt the foremost expert on Hudson Valley architecture. He's made the study of our region's art and architecture his life's work, and in many respects this book is the culmination of his career and his study of that field. It's a tremendous work of not only scholarship, but it's also a fun read. You could look at an architectural textbook. He visits 325 different sites throughout Ulster County, every township, including the city of Kingston, and not only describes the building and why it is significant, but he goes into detail as far as the historical context of the time that the structure was built, the architects involved, the builders, the owners over the years. Some of the entries are fairly short. Some are some run several pages, depending on how much Mr. Rhodes found to talk about. It's a wonderful book. I know it'll be very well received in Ulster County, but I think for anybody interested in the culture and the historical heritage of the entire Hudson River Valley, this is the book they would want to read. We have a nice event planned for Saturday, November 19th. At the Friends of Historic Kingston Gallery. I didn't bring the address with me, unfortunately, so I can't give that out. For more information, I would direct your listeners to the Friends of Historic Kingston's website, which is fohk.org. That would give you directions and a way to contact them. You could also contact me through blackdomepress.com if you need directions or help finding the event. It's going to run from 1 to 4 in the afternoon. Dr. Rhodes will give a slide lecture at 2 o'clock. Mm-hmm. There'll be a book signing before and after. Dr. Rhodes is preparing a nice exhibit from his private and very extensive collection of old photographs and postcards of some of the structures that he talks about in his book.
Mm-hmm. And what other titles have you published recently that listeners might be interested in?
One of our previous books, just before this, that we came out with in early 2010, has been our best-selling book ever.
Oh.
And that's the book that won the IPPI, the Independent Publishers Award, for took the silver medal for Northeast Regional Nonfiction. The title is Bloody Mohawk, The French and Indian War and American Revolution on New York's Frontier. Extraordinary story, covers the 18th century conflicts in New York that pretty much ran through the entire 18th century. Not just the Revolution, not just the French and Indian War, but the wars that preceded the French and Indian War. And Dr. Beleth does a wonderful job tying together an immense amount of material and making a very readable story. It reads like a novel. It's been a fantastic book.
And the author?
The author is Dr. Richard Beleth. He's not an historian by trade. He is a professor. He's the chair of communication arts at St. Francis College in Brooklyn. But he spent a lot of time in upstate New York. He's a fly fisherman. He gets up here every time he can get away from class. And he started researching the book. He became fascinated by the history as he would drive through the Mohawk River Valley looking for places to fish. He kept seeing all these historical markers, and that kind of piqued his interest. And he did about 10 years of research, wrote the book, and the results have been phenomenal.
What sells these days? I mean, you mentioned this book, and is it the story that really sold
as far
it?
As Bloody Mohawk, what readers have really responded to is the fact that the history of limiting it to the Revolution. Most of the history of the Revolution that were taught back in grade school and high school, most people know about the Battle of Saratoga, the so-called turning point of the war. And then the spotlight really drifts off New York until you come to the climactic battle outside of Yorktown in the south. Bloody Mohawk illustrates that New York remained the center of conflict. There was a guerrilla war, basically a civil war, raging throughout the entire frontier in New York, all the way from Canada down through the Mohawk, along the Mohawk Valley into Pennsylvania. That was horrific, incredibly bloody, terrible conflict. The author estimates that of the 20,000 or so inhabitants of the Mohawk Valley before the Revolution, only about a third of them remained at war's end. The rest had been captured, killed, driven off, or missing. Nobody knew what happened to them. Terrible conflict and a little-known story.
But fascinating.
Fascinating. Yeah. One of the things I enjoy about whenever I get a good manuscript and start reading a little more, finding something I didn't know about local history, is all of the kind of hidden areas of history that that haven't been well written about in the past, but are absolutely fascinating.
If you've just joined us, you are listening to Between the Lines, and I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and we are talking to Steve Orr, who is the new owner of Black Dome Press. What do you have planned for the future? What do you have in the pipeline?
I have a very nice book coming out in the late spring. It's a kayaker's guide to Lake George, Saratoga, and the Sacandaga region, written by one of the most prolific authors that our area has or has ever had. This will be Russell Dunn's 10th book in the past 11 years. Mm-hmm. It will be the 9th book that Black Dome Press has published. Russell Dunn, his books are all very popular. He's written 5 guides to waterfalls, all within maybe a 100-mile radius of Albany, New York, where Russell lives. He's written, this will be his second kayaking guide, and he's also written a very popular series called Trails with Tales, which so far there are 2 books in this series, and there will probably be more because he's so industrious. All of his books have been popular. What people love about his books are the fact that he not only tells you, you know, for example, when you're kayaking, where to launch and, you know, what to look out for in the water, what dangers there might be, etc., but he goes into the history along the way. You might be paddling along the Hudson and see some ruins on the side of the Hudson River and wonder what was there. Russell Dunn tells you.
Do you come up with the ideas? Do people come to you? Are you open to people coming to you, or how does that work?
Generally, people come to me. Right now, I have about 6 or 7 submissions on my desk waiting for my attention. I like to get to those as quickly as I can, but sometimes, particularly now, I'm still getting organized, and with the new book coming out, mm-hmm. things are particularly hectic right now, so I do apologize to those authors if you are listening. I will get to those, and I will respond as soon as possible. They find us. We also, I just mentioned Russell Dunn. I'll be publishing his 10th book. It'll be his 9th book for Black Dome Press. Mm-hmm. So we also do work with our previous authors as well. Bill Rhodes, the author of Ulster County, New York, wrote a previous book for Black Dome Press called Kingston, New York. That was a history and guide to the architecture, but just of the city of Kingston. Mm-hmm. Very popular books, went through 3 print runs, very well received critically and popularly. So when we find a good author like that, if they have another book, it's almost a no-brainer. I whip out the contract.
And what excites you when you see a sort of a submission coming in? What is it you're looking for?
Looking for a number of things. First of all, is it well written? If it's not the best written book in the world, but there's good content, we can work with that as well. I was the editor at Black Dome for a number of years, and I'm still the editor, as well as everything else. I'm the shipping manager too. So it's content. We've had some authors who had never written a book before.
And to what extent do you work with them in that case?
I try to work with the author as much as possible. I always keep in mind that first and foremost, this is their book, and it's their voice. So I don't want to take it out of their voice and make it my voice. Depending on the writer's ability, this recent book by Bill Rhodes, basically I did a proofreading and corrected a few typos. He's a very good writer. Being editor was a very easy job. Sometimes it's more involved. Sometimes I really almost have to rewrite the book. Mm. But I do that as gently as I can, and staying faithful to the material, and also trying to stay faithful to the author's particular voice and his tone.
Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about? Anything that you'd like to add?
No, and I think it's been a good interview. I think you touched a lot of the important points about the publishing world today, particularly as it pertains to a small regional press such as Black Dome. All that I would like to add is to all the listeners out there, and as I mentioned earlier, Amazon is a very good customer of Black Dome Press, but please don't forget to support your local stores, unless you want to live in a world where there are no bookstores someday, because it's heading that way.
Yeah, it's a good point, yes. I recently did a series on the local indie bookstores in Greene and Columbia counties, and in almost every case, they all have something else other than just books.
Exactly. A good case in point is there's a wonderful independent bookstore right here in Hudson.
Spotty Dog.
The Spotty Dog.
Yes, they're big supporters of our station.
Yeah.
It so happens.
And it's a wonderful store.
Great pub.
It is.
Great beer.
I haven't tried the beer there because I've only been there during the day when I was making a delivery or stopping to chat with the owner, Kelly. Yeah. But I'm anxious to try it. Maybe I'll pop in on the way home tonight.
Sounds like a good plan. Well, thank you so much for being on Between the Lines, Steve Orr. And once again, the new book coming out this Saturday is called?
Saturday, November 19th, 1 to 4 p.m. Please try to get there as early as possible. We do expect that it will be very crowded. It's a relatively small gallery. Bill Rhodes' lecture and slideshow will be starting at 2 p.m.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
And we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll come back with our next guest, Judy Staber. Stay tuned.
Well, she tossed all night like a raging sea, woke up and climbed from a suicide machine. with her Spanish candles and her Persian palms, stuck on the rocks inside Opus 40 stone. And scratching her wrists in the pouring rain, she collapses down upon the ocean floor.
My next guest is Judy Staber, writer, actor, director, producer, poet, art curator, and wife and mother. Did I leave anything out?
Grandmother.
Oh, right. Okay. Grandmother too. Judy is a writer, actor, and producer of Ménagerie à Trois, a pantomime that combines the intertwined fairy stories of Goldilocks and the Three Bears and the Three Little Pigs. It's performed by the Pantaloons, the performance troupe started by Judy 12 years ago. And it opens on Thanksgiving weekend at the Ghent Playhouse. Welcome to Between the Lines, Judy.
Thank you, Anne. So nice to be here.
Tell me about this pantomime. First of all, just explain what a pantomime is in case people are unclear.
All right. A British pantomime is you take a fairy story and you twist it, and you throw in a lot of jokes and a lot of political commentary and a few favourite songs that people will know, but you sort of rewrite the lyrics. And you have a lot of gender bending. In England, we always have a principal boy. That would be the Prince Charming, for instance, who is always played by a very leggy woman. And the comic part, the dame, is always played by a man. We've gone much further than that. We do a huge amount of gender bending. When we first started, the first one we did was Cinderella, and we were a little nervous. We didn't know how Americans would take gender bending. They loved it. And so it's just gone from one thing. It just gone from rather a sort of simple British panto to now it's something that's really American. The Pantaloons are a troupe of local actors that I managed to pull together in the year 2000, and we've been together ever since. We have lost a few, and we have gained a few, but we're still about 11 people.
And so specifically, this panto, Menagerie à Trois, tell me exactly what it's about.
Well, every year I have to come up with something. We have done a couple of repeats, but we've been rather successful merging two stories. In the past, we've done Heirloom, which was Rapunzel and Rumpelstiltskin merged, and we've also done Lost the Grimm Years, which is about Little Red Riding Hood and Hansel and Gretel. And they all end up at the witches, and they all end up with the wolf, and it's all quite fun. Nobody actually gets eaten. So this year, I wanted to do something similar and decided to do... Originally, it was going to be three kinds of threes, three blind mice as well. But then we simplified it, and one of our company had the idea of doing a sort of Romeo and Juliet. So we sort of have the Montagues and the Capulets, except that they're the pigs and the bears. And instead of having same-sex marriage, we have interspecies marriage.
Right.
Which is quite
modern.
Fun.
may I ask which species it is that intermarries?
Pigs and bears.
All right, okay.
You see, the youngest male pig falls in love with the youngest bear, who is now grown up. She was baby bear. Goldilocks has stayed on as nurse and she's now a little aging, so.
Okay.
It's very crazy. It's nutty.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot of fun. And obviously, so when you have the same people who keep mm-hmm. coming back, presumably you also got the same audiences as well who keep coming
back.
Oh,
yes. We have people who come every year and have come to every single one of them. Some of them come more than once. We're also adding people. We get people like last year who came and said, I'd never been before. How come? Why haven't I come? I said, well, we say, well, it's not for want of telling you, you know. So now they've gotten hooked too, I guess, yeah.
And of course, a pantomime tends to be a bit interactive. You have audience participation, don't you?
Absolutely. It's behind you.
In front of you.
You have to hiss when the villain comes on and boo, and cheer when the hero comes on, and you get the audience gets asked questions. Sometimes they're asked to sing along. It's generally great fun for children of all ages, from 5 to 95.
You yourself are obviously English. Why don't you tell us a bit about your own background?
Oh, your Scottish is coming out. Well, I was born into a theatrical family, so I come by it legally. My mother was an actress, in fact, played several pantomime fairies and queens and empresses and things.
So you have a long history of pantomimes.
Yeah. My father was a theatre manager in London, and I grew up in England. Actually, I grew up at a place called the Actors' Orphanage, which I've written a book about, but that's another story. And I grew up with 50 children, other children, all of whom were children of the theatre. So we always got free tickets to theatre. We went to the Windsor Panto every year, and we went to the Pantos in London. And so I sort of grew up with all of that, and then I came over to America when I finished school, and I married an actor. I should have known better, but I did. And so I went in, before that I went into the theater, which is how I met an actor in the first place. I never did any pantos when I was younger. I was just in the theater in New York, married an actor, had children, gave up acting, and moved up to the Berkshires and became a publicist, basically, for the arts organizations. I worked for Shakespeare and Company for about 8 years. I worked for the Berkshire Museum. I worked for Music Theatre Group. when my marriage broke up and my children went off to college and to life, I married again, moved to Columbia County, and was hired in 1996 to run the Spencertown Academy, which I'm happy to say I did, and I loved it. I had a wonderful time for almost 9 years, and it was there that the Pantaloons was born. And they were born because there was an English woman who used to come to the academy, and she said to me, "Have you ever thought about doing a panto?" Mm. And I said, "No, but it's a good idea." And she said, "Oh, I miss them so much, and I want my kids to see them." So I said, "All right, well, we'll give it a go." So I wrote a script for Cinderella and I hauled together a whole bunch of local actors.
Thespians.
Well, they were would-be actors or they were actors. But we started, and it was a huge success. We started by doing it just for one weekend. We had to extend the run, then, of course, for another weekend. And then people couldn't do it because they had other commitments. And so we got so many phone calls that we decided we'd do it in February vacation. We did it then and sold out again. Somebody said, "Oh, you can't bring it back. You'll never bring it back. They won't come." Well, we sold out again. So we decided that was it. So we did another one. And now we're doing number 12.
Gosh.
So it took off.
Yeah,
and all the scripts are original, based on the stories, but twisted, of course. And we parody songs, popular songs, songs people know. Sometimes it's Gilbert and Sullivan, sometimes it's Sondheim, but they're parodied, you know, twisted, and the verses are very different. And we tell jokes, and we have a lot of political stuff comes in, and of course the politicians are very good and give us lots of stuff, lots and lots of lines. So, and the dialogue changes actually even after we've opened, because somebody in Washington does something incredibly dumb,
yes.
and there it goes.
Yeah. Do the Pantaloons do anything else other than the pantomime?
No. They all go off on their merry way. I write the script in the summer, run it by our director, Tom Detweiler, who's been with me since, this is his 10th show. And I run it by him, and then we have a read-through in September, and everybody screams and yells and say they hate it or they love it or whatever, and then I take it and put it into some better shape, and then we start rehearsals, which we are in now. And everybody adds stuff. I mean, other people write lyrics. Other people throw in jokes. I have a wonderful young actor who was with us several times and then wasn't with us for a while, and he's come back this year. His name's Walter Bauer, and he's playing the wolf. And he just comes up with the most wonderful lines. I mean, everybody does. It's just, you know. I mean, the bears don't eat the pigs because the bears are Jewish.
Oh, right,
so
okay.
They don't eat pork. We could have had them be Muslim, but we thought it'd be better if they were Jewish. So.
No, I know that I didn't ask you this before, but is there any sort of a sample of lyrics or anything that you could give us?
Well,
a little selection from the pantomime?
I don't know about a selection. I mean, I can tell you that there is a scene rather like the Jet song in West Side Story, where the pigs come over to annoy the bears because the bears have been over poking around the pig's house and broken the handle off the hydrofracking pump. And the pigs are going to be hydrofracking. The pigs are rather right wing, and the bears are rather laid back and left wing. So there's a political thing going on here too, and so we have instead of when you're a jet, it's when you're the pigs or the bears. I mean, it's all twisted and different. So that's one thing. Mama Bear and Father Bear. I'm playing Father Bear, and Paul Murphy plays Mama Bear, and we are fed up with the pigs because they're always annoying us, and all we want to do is just hang out and be, just lie around in the sun. And so the song we picked is, instead of Kids from Bye Bye Birdie, it's Pigs. And, you know, so that's the sort of thing we do. Yeah, I'm not about to sing on the radio.
Sure, no?
No.
Okay.
No, no.
Do you ever run out of stories? This is your 12th year.
Well, we've done Cinderella twice, and we've done Puss in Boots twice. Those are the only repeats we've done. And they were both different each time. The first Puss in Boots was called Puss in Boots and the Witch of Punset Creek and was very much geared to Spencer Town. And it was during the time of the St. Lawrence cement thing. So the witch was burning foul stuff and, you know. And whereas the second time around, it was called A Tale of Two Kitties. And it was a little different. It didn't have quite the same local. Do we run out of stories? I don't know. Ask me that next year. you do. I mean, there are some that just don't lend themselves. I mean, Sleeping Beauty, for instance. I mean, you know, you got the beginning with the fairies, and then everybody's asleep for 100 years.
Or Rip Van Winkle.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah, yeah, you could, yeah. So, yeah.
So when you're not doing pantomimes, what else are you doing?
Writing. And I just finished my memoir. I've been writing a whole lot of stories, short stories, about New York in the 60s, which is when I was on my own in the 60s in New York. Sort of studying acting, working three jobs, living in a five-flight walk-up, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I just actually just entered a short story in the Hudson Valley Writers Guild, and I came in first, and I won a nice little check.
Congratulations.
That was ever so nice, yes.
So
very affirming.
Yeah, I would say so, absolutely.
Yeah, right.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
So you might have a book of short stories coming out then.
Well, I don't know. The publishing industry now is so, it's difficult. It's with the economy and with the whole e-books and self-publishing has just taken off and it's become the way to go.
Now, did you self-publish your memoir?
Yeah, I did. I had an agent in England. And he was shopping it around. And he started shopping it around in October 2008. I don't know if you remember what happened then, but the world economy crashed. Mm-hmm. And I don't think British publishing houses were taking flyers on a little bit of English history in the 50s written by an unknown. I mean, you know.
Although memoirs are huge right now. So many people are writing them.
There's a possibility that it might go somewhere. I felt I just had to get it out there. I mean, I'd been working on it for 10 years, and I just said, I got to get this out there. So I did.
Now, once again, the title of the memoir is?
It's called Silverlands, Growing Up at the Actors' Orphanage.
And if people wanted to get hold of it, how could they do that?
Well, it's on Amazon. It's actually on Kindle, too, except at the moment I've got it on draft on Kindle because I had to make a couple of changes. It's available through the Troy Bookmakers in Troy. Mm-hmm. So three places. And at local bookstores.
Absolutely. Bookstores? Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's at the Chatham Bookstore and the Bookloft in Great Barrington and the bookstore in Lenox and the bookhouse in Stuyvesant Plaza.
Yeah. I mean, so much of being an author today, whether you're self-published or whether you go through the traditional publishers, is that you have to market it yourself. Do you have to do a lot of that?
Yeah, I do. And you know, even though I worked as an arts publicist for 30 years, it's a whole other thing to sell yourself. It's much harder. Because you sort of feel, you know. And so it's very difficult. And I've done a lot of readings. And But it's doing it in this area is one thing, because people know me and it's sold. I mean, I've sold almost 400 books. But
that's terrific.
I know. It's good. It is good. And it's on Kindle, too, and I don't know how many I've sold on that yet. And they just had a meeting of the Actors Charitable Trust, which was the charity I grew up under, the annual general meeting, and I sent Robert 16 books, and he sold them all.
Fantastic.
And he's going to want more. But the trouble is that with Amazon, because it's Amazon.com, not .co.uk, they have to ship it from here, and the postage is very expensive.
You can't get it on Amazon UK?
Well, then they'd have
to.
They'd
have a market.
Well, they'd have to have a stash of them over there, because you know. So, I don't know. I'd like to look into that, but. Yeah. Got a lot of other things to do.
Yes. And is there like a self-publishing chart or something, a bestseller chart that you can measure your own sales up against other people's?
I don't know. I haven't looked into all of that. I know my friend Rebecca McBride,
right.
And she and I chat periodically and how are you doing and, you know. It's very tough, you know.
Right, 'cause of course Rebecca was also on the show and... she also self-published her memoir.
Yes, yeah, and with a different publishing company, but still the same thing. I mean, both of us going out and doing readings. And I don't know how you get into the broader market. I mean, I suppose you could spend a lot of money doing it, but I don't have that kind of money.
Well, one way to do it is blogs. You have.
Well, I have a web. Mm-hmm. We have a website, my husband and I, and. You know, I've got stuff on there, and I do add stuff to it from time to time. And people read the blog, but I don't know how many of them actually buy the book from the blog, you know.
Right.
That's hard to measure.
Just to get back to the pantomime now. So
right.
It's opening on Thanksgiving weekend.
Can yes.
you tell us the times?
We decided to do it at Thanksgiving, which is the American family holiday, the secular holiday. So we've always opened the Friday after Thanksgiving, and we do four performances that weekend because we figure people have house guests, and after a day or two, they want to know what to do with them. So we open on Friday night, the 25th, I think it is. It's the day after Thanksgiving anyway. And we do two performances on Saturday, one at 5 and one at 8. The Friday night is at 8. And then we always do a matinee on Sunday at 2. And it's, the 25th is the opening day. And then it runs for the following two weekends, Friday and Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 2, and closes on the 11th of December. So we do 10 performances.
Okay. Judy, is there anything else that you'd like to add that I haven't asked you about?
Well, I probably should tell you that the Ghent Playhouse is it's a charming little playhouse. It's 104 seats, totally handicap accessible, very comfortable seats. We do five productions a year. We've just closed Dial M for Murder, which did very well, except it had to have Saturday night's performance was cancelled on account of that dumping we got. Then there's the Panto, and then in January we're doing You're in Town, a musical.
So just let me stop you for a moment. And your connection with the Ghent Playhouse is?
Well, originally it was just to bring the Panto there. I was invited to bring the Panto there. And then they asked me if I'd go on the board, so I'm on the board.
Ah, okay.
And of course I do all the publicity.
Wear many hats.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you've been a publicist for 30 years, that's why they want you on a board most of the time. But I'm on the board. And so, and then we're doing Pack of Lies in March and the Mad Woman of Chaillot in May. And we perform in the winter when the other people are not, so to speak. Last year, I directed You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, which was my first go at directing, and it was a huge... lot of fun. Great, great show.
Wow.
And it was really fun. I've never directed before, and I had a ball.
Wow. So yeah. It's not non-stop action and challenges and fun.
Well, no, I guess my mum did that too, so, you know.
Runs in the family.
Yeah.
Okay, Judy Staber, writer, actor, director, I want to thank you so much for being on Between the Lines.
Should I give you the phone numbers?
And yes, give us the phone numbers.
All right, reservations for the panto, and I should tell you December 3rd is already sold out. The telephone number is 518-392-6264, and you leave your number and somebody will call you back. And if you want to see the panto, especially Thanksgiving weekend, you need to make reservations. And if you want to know more about the Ghent Playhouse, it's www.ghentplayhouse.org.
Okay, thank you so much, Judy.
Thank you, Anne.
From school are we, but as a schoolgirl well can be, filled to the brim with girlish glee. Three little maids from school,
everything is a source of fun.
Nobody's safe or we care for none.
Life is a joke that's just begun.
Three little maids from school. Three little maids who all unwary come from a lady's seminary. Three little maids from school. Three little maids from school.
One little maid is a bride, yum yum.
Two little maids in attendance come.
Three little maids is the total sum.
Three little maids from school.
From three little maids, take one away.
Two little maids remain, and they
won't have to wait very long, they say.
Three little maids from school. Three little maids from school. Three little maids who all unwary come from a lady's seminary. Three from a genius tutelary.
Three little maids from school.
Three little maids from school.
And that's my show for today. And I will be back the third Thursday in December at 2 p.m.
Memory is cruel. Calling up attention to details. Defending intentions if he fails. Until now. Familiar in a way, but I could have sworn I'd heard him say it 10,000 times. Oh, if only I had been listening. Leave unsaid, unspoken. Eyes wide shut. Between the lines. sweet.